Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, November 8th, 2008. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. The next 10 days are going to be crucial in determining what your future will be. There will be two meetings sponsored by LaRouche PAC to address this crisis. On November 11th, Lyndon LaRouche will be speaking at a private meeting to discuss his proposal for a new Bretton Woods and to work on an organizing drive for this. Then on November 18th, he will speak at a LaRouche PAC webcast, which will begin at 1 p.m. Eastern, and you can pick that up on the LaRouche PAC website. And in fact, you should be organizing people for that, so that's November 18th at 1 p.m. In between, on November 15th, there will be a meeting of the Group of 20 at the White House. As of the moment, it appears that between Bush and Britain's Prime Minister Gordon Brown, nothing of significance will be allowed to occur at that meeting. Meanwhile, the financial disintegration, which has been accurately forecast by Lyndon LaRouche at each successive stage, is wiping out trillions of dollars in pension funds and retirement funds. The stock market is collapsing. We're seeing the bankruptcy of large and small corporations, with the three U.S. automakers heading into bankruptcy. Millions of foreclosures, collapsing banks, and on top of this, a destruction of the global food supply, and nations are turning into, actually are being destroyed by this. Now, as LaRouche warned, the Bush-Paulson-Pelosi bailout, which could better be described as a plan to save the financial institutions of the City of London, has done nothing to loosen credit, nor was it ever intended to do so. And while the voters of the United States elected a new president, there's no indication as of the moment that this will mean any change in policy. Is there any hope that there can be a break with this present failed policy with its failed axioms? Well, that's what we're going to discuss today. And joining us on the LaRouche Show will be Jeffrey Steinberg of the editorial board of the Executive Intelligence Review. And we'll also hear from members of a LIM panel, LaRouche Youth Movement panel, and today that will include Delonte Best from Los Angeles and Diana Wang from the LIM War Room. So Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley.
Why don't you begin by giving us an update on what is the status at the moment of the global economy?
Well, since the middle of September, we've been in a process of total disintegration and global bankruptcy, which is being scarcely concealed by this massive bailout attempt. And we've reached now the point where the monetary and financial disintegration has hit hard at the real economy. People saw the jump in the unemployment rate here in the United States that was announced on Friday. And really, everyone knows these figures are completely faked, and that a good rule of thumb is to assume that whatever the official figure is, it's at least double that. So we're already up around 15-20% unemployment in the United States. You already mentioned that General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler are all set to go down the tubes. Yesterday, General Motors admitted that basically they don't have the money to survive until the end of the year. So we're not just talking about bankruptcy, because as people may recall, probably every remaining airline company in the United States has been in and out of bankruptcy at least once. Those are working bankruptcies where they went through some debt restructuring but kept their doors open and continued to do business. In the case of GM, we could very well be looking at a literal shutdown of what was once the largest automobile manufacturer in the world.
Yeah, they're running out of money. They say they don't even have money to keep the lights on.
Exactly. And Ford has burned through about $7 billion in cash on hand to keep their doors open. So the idea that somehow or other Ford is going to survive and General Motors is going to go under is preposterous. We're about to see the loss of the entire what's left of the U.S. automobile sector.
And Jeff, you know, when we talk about this, it you know, my first thought is, we told you so. I mean, this is what Lynn had been talking about going back to 2005, 2006. We brought in members of the United Auto Workers. Lynn sent a letter to the head of Ford Motor Company. We did everything we could to move these guys, and now they're sitting there saying, give us a bailout so we can build new fuel-efficient cars that look like pregnant roller skates.
Well, what they're really asking for is bailout money to just simply be able to keep their doors open. They're really not talking about any restructuring or new product line or any of that. They just want the money so that they can basically survive into January of next year. Now, look, the big issue really is that we're continuing to go through a hyperinflationary bailout of what is ultimately a derivatives apparatus, a derivatives bubble that is in the quadrillions of dollars. And it's impossible to bail out. Therefore, so long as there is an attempt to defend the current monetary system and to bail these institutions out, then we're spiraling straight down into hell. Now, the other...
Jeff, let me just on that point, because there are some people who say, well, doesn't Paulson know this? Don't they know that? It's evident that when you're talking about quadrillions of dollars in obligations, $700 billion doesn't go that far. So clearly, there's no serious intention to do a bailout that would work. So what is it that they're thinking?
They're thinking that they want to get out of town in one piece. they're really not thinking. First of all, nobody knows the size of this derivatives bubble because it's offshore, it's unregulated. The problem is that the major holders of these derivative contracts are banks, either directly or through offshore hedge funds that they've created to handle their derivatives activities. So each individual bank knows that they are hopelessly bankrupt. But they also have no idea what the situation is for any other bank. And so therefore, they simply assume that everybody's in the same boat, that the entire system is bankrupt. And so as the result of that, critical things like letters of credit that are the basis for all world trade and commerce have completely frozen up. China is going through hell right now because they've lost their entire export revenue stream. And so you've got thousands of Chinese companies, small, medium-sized, large companies, that have gone into bankruptcy in the recent period because they can't get their exports on ships and delivered to destinations because the whole letter of credit system has blown out because the trillions and trillions, really tens of trillions of dollars in losses that have already been incurred means that the money is not there. So only a bankruptcy reorganization and a transfer from a monetary system to a credit system is going to work. Nothing else will work, and it's not just a matter of we're going to hit bottom and it'll look bad on the books of some banks. We will go colliding downward into a dark age.
Now, Jeff, I want to talk a lot about this credit versus monetary system because that's what Lyndon LaRouche has put on the table. But the starting point for that, you mentioned it just a minute ago, bankruptcy reorganization. With the banks in the shape they're in, with this unknowable hole, why is it that there's resistance to this idea of bankruptcy reorganization? And I don't just mean from the banks, because clearly there are jobs at stake, there are people's careers and so on, but what you're really looking at here is something which is a chasm which can't be filled. Why is it that in the Congress and elsewhere, there's not a call to join with LaRouche for bankruptcy reorganization?
Well, I think you're going to see a little bit more of people coming forward as the new Congress comes in, because there's a small, precious handful of people who do understand what's going on and who may have the courage to do something about it. But by and large, you're dealing with rampant stupidity and rampant corruption. And I don't know whether to put corruption first before stupidity or the other way around, but those are the two dominant factors. When you see people like Chris Dodd or even Barney Frank, in Chris Dodd's case, I think you can really make a compelling case for stupidity. In Barney Frank's case, I think he understands a little bit more, but that is where the corruption factor is so overwhelming that it's just a barrier. You know, well, I mean, why is Barney Frank the guy who's putting forward federal legislation for marijuana decriminalization on behalf of George Soros? That tells you something about how corrupt he is.
Well, and in a couple of minutes when we bring in the LIM panel, we'll also talk about the other side of the corruption, which is the destruction of education and even the ability to think. But let's look at these two points then. There's LaRouche has insisted you need bankruptcy reorganization, and then he's also said that the New Bretton Woods is not just a slogan, but represents a very distinct difference between a system of credit and a system of monetary manipulation. What is the difference? Why don't we start with what's the difference between the two?
Well, the only system that is a credit system in the world today is the system that was established by our founding fathers in the U.S. Constitution. And we've abused the Constitution to an incredible degree by allowing ourselves to become captives of the British monetary system, particularly after 1971. But look, our Constitution authorizes Congress to pass legislation permitting the federal government to incur debt, some of which takes the form of the issuance of money and other instruments of credit. But always, Congress should be specifying what it is that we're going to be incurring the debt to accomplish. The Constitution in the preamble laid out what the mission of the federal government is, to do things like promote the general welfare, provide for the common defense, to guarantee posterity. So when Congress used to pass appropriations, which basically then authorized the issuance of government debt, it was always tied to specific projects, very often infrastructure projects. The federal government is responsible for, under the General Welfare Clause, for developing our national key infrastructure. Under the Common Defense Clause of the preamble, we're responsible for fielding an army and other kinds of necessary services in the defense of the country. So those kinds of things are what governments issue credit and incur debt to accomplish. So under a credit system, you're not just throwing money out there. You're saying we are going to spend money on the following vitally necessary issues, and Congress debates and votes these things up. And under a system in which you've got true representation, members of Congress will be using a standard for determining what investments and what incurring of debts in the national interest and what's not.
Well, Jeff, then it seems from what you're saying that the idea of a bankruptcy reorganization and a credit system go hand in hand, because you're also determining areas of the economy which are hopelessly bankrupt where you're not going to channel money.
Sure. Look, prior to 1971, the mechanisms by which the U.S. government issued credit and incurred debt, and some of that involved monetized debt, printing of money through the Treasury, through the Fed, was all based on this credit system that we described. In 1971, the Nixon administration formally ended the Bretton Woods agreements, which broke a treaty arrangement under which the United States had relations with other governments around the world that extended our credit system to those other governments. After 1971, the dollar became a kind of a free-floating instrument, and then within a year or two, between the British and the Saudis and some other oil-producing countries, you got the phenomenon of the great oil hoax, where there never was a shortage of oil, but where nevertheless the price of oil was artificially driven up. A spot market was created in Europe, and suddenly you had this thing called euro dollars and petrodollars, where mechanisms for generating new US-denominated, dollar-denominated monetary instruments was no longer in the sovereign control of the US government. And so we were in effect, with the end of Bretton Woods, drawn into the global British monetary system. And from that point onward, the dollar has not been the sovereign currency of the United States, has not been exclusively controlled through the constitutional structures of the Congress, but it's become part of the globalized funny money system.
You're listening to Jeff Steinberg from the Executive Intelligence Review, a longtime collaborator and associate of Lyndon LaRouche. This is the LaRouche Show. We can take your email questions. Send them to radio@larouchepub.com. You can send them. We'll pick them up and be happy to answer your questions. We're going to hear from the LaRouche Youth Movement in just a moment. Jeff, I remember you talking about this oil hoax. The first deployment I did in Houston, Texas, was standing outside the Royal Dutch Shell building in downtown Houston with a sign that said, "Out of gas, my ass." And even the Houstonians flocked to the sign at that point. Now, we're talking about the intervention that Lyndon LaRouche has made around the idea of bankruptcy reorganization and going back to a credit-based monetary system as specified by the U.S. Constitution and as implemented by Franklin Roosevelt with regulating banking and then the Bretton Woods system. Now, Jeff, there's going to be a meeting on November 15th, and we have what the LIM called the New Bretton Woods that's going to be presented by Brown, the Prime Minister of Britain, and an effort to establish a global monetary authority. There is talk about a new Bretton Woods, but it's somewhat scattered and compromised. What do you think will occur at this November 15th meeting?
Well, if all of these factors that you just identified are allowed to play out, the meeting will be a disaster. In fact, the French financial press is warning that if, as expected, the meeting accomplishes nothing or worse than nothing, then expect that the very first day that trading opens in Asia on the world stock markets, that you are going to get a black Monday crash that will be followed by a terrible Tuesday, a worse Wednesday, and that the whole system is going to blow. So it's precisely because of this that Lyndon LaRouche has convened a private discussion that will take place on Tuesday, November 11th. We expect to have high-level representation from quite a number of the governments that will be present at the Group of 20 meeting just a few days later. And we don't have any delusions that we're going to win the fight in a one-day meeting chaired by George Bush with Gordon Brown goosing him under the table. But the idea is that governments have to understand this issue, and they have to understand, as LaRouche understands, that there is one factor that is completely non-negotiable. That if you don't go back to a global credit system based on a treaty agreement and a restoration of a credit system in the United States where it's written into the Constitution, then we're going to plunge into a dark age, and it's going to take 2 to 3 generations before humanity crawls out of the mud. So the stakes are unbelievable. There has never been a situation like the situation that humanity is facing over the immediate days and weeks ahead. When I say that we're about to plunge into a dark age. I mean that the current global population of over 6.5 billion people will be reduced to between 1 and 2 billion people, or maybe even below 1 billion people within one or two generations. Because physical economy says that you need a certain carrying capacity to sustain population levels at 6.5 billion people. And that if you fail to meet that carrying capacity requirement, by which I mean food, energy, sanitation, all of the kinds of things that go into the conditions of life, if you fail to maintain those standards, then you don't have a gradual and slow decline in world population. You have a precipitous crash, because you're going to get eruptions of disease. You're going to get plant and animal disease, human disease. Pandemics are going to spread around the globe, and it's going to look a lot worse than anything that Boccaccio imagined in his accounts of the Dark Age of Europe in the 14th century.
Well, you also get wars, as we're seeing now in the Congo, the destabilization of Pakistan, and so on. Jeff, before I bring in Diana and Delonte, let me just ask you, you do a lot of work on Capitol Hill. You've been talking with staffers for quite a while. Do they get the depth of the crisis yet? And are there some there who are moving toward advocating LaRouche's New Bretton Woods?
There's a handful who see that Lyndon LaRouche has been right, and who see the merits of all of what he has proposed as solutions. But those people, by and large, are despairing over the horrible state of leadership in the Congress, starting with Nancy Pelosi. And therefore, they are caught up in a classic tragedy, where the tragedy is not some heroic individual who blinks at the wrong moment. Tragedy is that an entire culture is unable to see that if they continue their current behavior, then they're going to all die. And the added dimension very often in tragedy is that there are unique individuals, geniuses, who know the solution, who understand the crisis, and who know exactly how to engineer survival, yet they are isolated and rejected. So Congress is sort of the epicenter of what right now has the potential to play out as a tragedy. It doesn't have to be a tragedy. Lyndon LaRouche is still around and kicking, and the alternatives of this credit system are on the table. This event on Tuesday is to bring together leading representatives of governments representing most of the group of 20 nations to seriously talk beforehand about what has to be done. So that even though no one expects that this conference is going to solve the problem, Bretton Woods was not a one-day affair. It was a working meeting, and things were hammered out. So what we want to do is get the alternative on the table, so that going into this meeting, the tough questions are put on the table, competent proposals are put on the table, and so that we're beginning an organizing process to organize a fundamental revolutionary change in the global financial and economic system, and a revolutionary change in the behavior of governments all over the world. It's doable. There's no question in my mind, there's no question in Lyndon LaRouche's mind, that this can be accomplished. But there's also no delusions about how tough a fight it is going to be. And one of the greatest weapons that we have at our disposal at this point is the speed with which everything is coming apart.
Well, I think that also brings us to the question of the organizing of the listeners to the program, because while Lynn is going to be organizing people at the top levels of governments, we have to create shock effects in the population. And one of the ways to do that is people listening to this program can download the paper that now appears on the website under the title, Whereas, a resolution drafted by Lyndon LaRouche on his proposal for a new Bretton Woods. Circulate that, call your congressman, mobilize like crazy, contribute to LaRouche PAC, and get everybody you know to watch the webcast on November 18th. Now, someone who's in the middle of this organizing process is Diana, who's in Purcellville, I guess, right now, near the headquarters at Leesburg. Diana, what is the LaRouche Youth Movement doing nationally to bring this new Bretton Woods into existence?
Well, there's a series and layers of things that the youth movement are doing right now nationally and even internationally. But my I have the best conception of what's happening inside the United States is that, I mean, people have to understand that, you know, we're not facing a depression, we're not facing, you know, another economic cycle, so to speak, right? It's not like, you know, 2 years from now we'll bounce back up. What we're facing is something comparable, and as LaRouche said, in some cases even worse than the 14th century New Dark Age. And that's what we have to communicate out there in the population, that look, you know, this is not going to be an apocalypse. This is not going to be a depression. This is going to be a dark age. And primarily because the ability for the ability of the industry and agriculture and sciences and technology of the world right now cannot sustain the current population. You know, not to mention the growth of the population. The relative potential population density is lower than that of what we have today, the population we have today. And that's what LaRouche is saying. So we have youth out there, you know, who are pioneering a series of different deployments. We have, you know, this is the best time to recruit youth, especially on the West Coast. Our locals there, they're about to have these cadre schools. I mean, in brief, what they are is that, you know, they're a weekend or a few days of an intense session to catch young people who aren't part of the movement, who aren't part of our movement, who are serious, catch them up to speed on how to organize and to conceptually digest what the crisis is and what the solutions are. And then also we have some youth who are pioneering diplomatic work, you would say. You have in Boston, for example, I mean, we have Lynn's new paper that just came out. And we wanted to saturate a very targeted section of the population, which, you know, include policymakers, diplomats, embassies, etc. So we had a couple of youth from our Boston local. You know, they just deployed to universities and contacted and directly met with and gave the paper to various professors and, you know, deans who would have sway, who would have influence in the policy making of a new Bretton Woods. You know, they talked to a bunch of professors and representatives of, you know, the Russian community, for example. Huh. And also, we're deploying youth out in every local in the West Coast to embassies to establish a relationship with them. And I spoke to Jeff the other day about how to approach the work with the diplomats and the embassies. And the key thing is, you know, we don't want to approach it pragmatically. We don't want to approach it from the standpoint that between, you know, now and the November 15th G20 summit that we're going to get them to do something, right, you know, like magic. What we want to do is we want to develop a relationship with these people, because diplomats, you know, people who have sway in international policy making, they can never learn enough about LaRouche's economics or about the American system, which is, you know, culturally superior to most economic and economic systems and national systems. So that's really taking off. That's really taking off. It's being pioneered.
Now, Diana, let me ask you a specific question that I know comes up from time to time, because I do a lot of work with the youth movement, as you know. And do you think that what Jeff laid out about a dark age, about the complete breakdown of the system, given that we're talking to people now 18 to 35 years old who have known nothing but the phony system of globalization and the computer sector and information society, do you think it's first of all, for the membership in the LaRouche Youth Movement, this idea of a dark age is clear? And then do you think we're communicating that effectively to students who are in sort of a la-la land of just hoping they can get money from their parents to pay their credit card bills?
Right, that's as if their parents didn't lose all their money in the stock market already.
Exactly. So let's start with, do you think members of the youth movement are, from the work that's being done, the material that's being posted on the website, the research you're doing, for example, in the war room and editorial, is it becoming increasingly clear what we mean by the total breakdown of the system?
I would say definitely. I mean, it's I've only been around for, you know, for a few years, but recently we've been getting reports from the locals about just the mass, the density of young people. We're talking about 17, 18, 19-year-olds, you know, in clusters coming into our offices getting serious, right? Holding up, holding LaRouche clubs on their campuses, bringing in contacts, you know. I mean, you have some of these young people who don't know exactly everything yet, but they're excited by the type of work we do. That, you know, they're going out there, they're putting themselves out there to organize other students, right? Not worrying about, you know, the popularity element. So that's definitely a breakthrough. And I mean, right now in the Percival deployment, which is kind of like the nexus, it's like the central node of the organizing and the youth movement. Right now we have, you know, in the basement, they're doing some pioneering work in the sciences, and they're producing videos. They have a plan to produce videos on the work they're doing to reveal some of the discoveries we're making down there. And out here in Percival, we've really standardized what we need to do in terms of the cranking out the production of the videos to educate a population between the ages of 18 to 35 who really can't read anymore. They can't, you know, understand a conception coming out of a paper, you know, a long article. They need the juxtaposition of sight and sound, which is, you know, the multimedia products, to help them understand crucial ideas that need to be understood immediately for us to win this fight.
Well, there are some very good videos that have been posted in the last week. There's one that's up on the Institution of the Presidency. And then there was sort of a three-part series on the question of corporatism and Keynes versus the new Bretton Woods that I would encourage people to go to the LaRouche PAC site and see. Now, I want to bring in Delonte, who's out on the West Coast. Delonte, the question that, just to follow up what I was just talking about with Diana, you had a whole lot of youth who were activated by the Obama campaign, which became a kind of popular opinion swamp, you might say, or Kool-Aid fest. What's your sense? How do you win people out of that? Because now the election's over. The hard reality is there. So far, Obama has given no indication that he's going to break at all from the policy of Paulson and Pelosi and Gordon Brown. What do you think? How do you break people out of that? Is it possible to get them to start thinking on a deeper level from your experience on the campuses recently?
Yeah, I think so. What's happened in a recent period is fun because we've intervened after the elections, or prior to the election and after the elections as well. And what we've noticed is that all the bright-eyed and bushy tails of people, as you said, are following the one, is no more there. The glamour of, okay, you ask people, has anything been resolved completely after this election? And most of the responses we get is no. And it's inevitable in terms of their response to that. And so what we're out to do in terms of the limb is to channel that excitement, but also in a certain sense enrage and ambiguity to a level and saying, okay, now let's work on the policy that has to shape the future of the United States economy and the world at large. And we've had people think through that because they know that the economy is in this collapsing phase. Even those who go to these more prestigious universities and are all well off, if you're able to communicate to them the question of their morality, like what are they going to do in terms of the whole breakdown, if that's effectively communicated, what Diane is saying is, if that's communicated that the whole system is breaking down and we're headed in and plunging into a dark age, what are you morally, personally going to do? And we've been able to at least break people out of that. And the effects of that is true, is we are having clumps of people coming around, signing up, joining as members, like actually putting down some kind of financial donation or whatnot to say, look, I will work with you for a longer term. So it is the case that these things can be broken. I think the website is extremely useful for that. It's a good tool to cut into these things. These videos that we're putting out, this is absolutely the cutting edge of what we're doing in terms of organizing that 18 to 35 bracket. Because it is true, at the same time, they can't read, but the mind, the human mind, is so powerful that they can obtain ideas. And since we do that very well, we've been able to attract people to the material much more. So.
And Dante, I know you did a class or a briefing a couple nights ago where you took up this question of the new Bretton Woods, the theme that LaRouche has put out on credit versus monetary system. Apparently there was a fairly large turnout at the Los Angeles office. Did people get the idea? Is it something that...
It was great. Yeah. It was great. It was packed in here, standing room. I haven't seen this in a while and really anywhere. And this comes off the heels of the town hall meeting that you and Nick Walsh actually led, also packed. And we're just seeing the dynamite of people and ready to just explode and work with us. People were getting it. It was in result of all the questions that were coming up, because the new Bretton Woods in and of itself has become a household name. And so this is, you'll see it whether it's in papers or just spread on some kind of talk show radio. But
they're mostly knockoffs.
Right. Yeah. And what was made clear to the, and I thought we, Sam and I made it very clear that this isn't some new thing that was just pulled out of the ass of LaRouche. He had been working for this since the 90s and calling for this, and governments in Europe particularly have been adopting this policy by name. LaRouche is New Bretton Woods in Italy, et cetera. And so it was good. I thought people attracted and got that question. But then what we also made clear, at least I did, was the British orientation of it. Because this is the thing that I think has to be communicated as well, that the American citizens have to have a very clear sense of who the enemy is. If they don't have that, and this is where it all comes down to, because the American revolutionists, the Civil War fighters, they all had a sense of who was trying to usurp or hijack the United States government and our Constitution, et cetera. So what was made clear was what LaRouche is doing and his new Bretton Woods and the people who are working with him, and then that of Gordon Brown and Tony Blair's British really imperialist policy, globalizational policy, was made very clear. And we had a lot of jokes on the British to kind of open up the thinking of people on how they operate globally. So.
Well, Jeff, I want to come back to you on a question. When I talked to Lynn the other night, he told me I can't toss you softballs. I have to give you some tough questions. So, look, one of the things
Mickey
that...
Mickey Mantle, 1962.
As Dalante was raising this question of Europe, we've seen the Italian finance minister Tremonti just last week identify Lyndon LaRouche's new Bretton Woods by name. There's discussion from Sarkozy, which is different, from the British, because he's calling for regulations on hedge funds, on the offshore islands and things of that sort. But Lynn has been absolutely clear in saying that this won't come from Europe because of the problems that exist with the European system. What is the difference then between what the EU might try to do or any of the countries in Europe with this constitutional process in the United States?
Well, look, the first problem you're going to get is they're going to try to play nicey-nice with the British. They don't see the British as the enemy of the survival of humanity. We have a report that we'll be producing today for the website and for our regular internal daily briefing, that there was a meeting of the European Union. The 27 European Union heads of state got together to try to come up with a common position going into this G20 meeting in Washington next weekend, and it was absolutely pathetic. It's the most mumbo-jumbo mixture of self-contradictory statements that you could imagine. And I think that the statement is an honest reflection of what happens when you sit down in a room and you've got completely incompatible positions and you try to come up with some kind of consensus document.
That's why LaRouche calls it the Tower of Babel.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, we know that there are real differentiated positions among the actual European governments and political institutions, but they tend to be too weak to actually act on their own. We know the best situation that we've got in Europe is with the Italian government, where Giulio Tremonti, the finance minister, has been someone who's been in a long-standing dialogue with Lyndon LaRouche personally, and he happens to agree and has the courage of conviction to put forward publicly that he wants to go with LaRouche's full-scale Bretton Woods credit system restructuring under bankruptcy. Others in the Italian government may not be willing to go that far. Sarkozy has gone so far as to say that he wants a return to a fixed exchange rate system. That's an important element of it. But so long as they try to basically keep some notion of European community unity, and they don't kick the British out of the room and reach a consensus to then dictate to the British, then they're not going to do diddly squat of any kind of use. So LaRouche is looking at nations that have a sense of independent global power. And the United States has that sense. The British have that sense from the standpoint that they've been running a global empire almost uninterrupted since 1763. But they're the enemy. They want oligarchical dictatorship and mass genocide. That's the policy of Prince Philip, of the Brown government. Then you've got Russia, which by force of the Cold War confrontation especially, had to emerge as a world power making strategic decisions that affected not only its own existence, but the existence of the world as a whole. And then you've got China and India, which are world powers by virtue of the fact that they've got each well over a billion people, and where China in particular has become the industrial slave labor capital of the entire planet. So you've got this combination. China is in a desperate situation because of the bankruptcy of the global system that they've been completely sucked into to their own detriment. Russia is coming to grips with the fact that they're not immune from the effects of the breakdown of the entire global financial system. If we get an anchor of the United States and Russia agreeing to push forward with LaRouche's new Bretton Woods policy, and that's going to be a battle in the United States even more than in Russia. But if we succeed in that, then China's on board, India is on board, and then you're going to have people beating down the door to sign up as part of this new system. Italy will be involved, France will go all the way, probably even Germany under Merkel will realize that this is the road to survival. South Korea, done deal. Japan, they'll go along with it, absolutely, certainly. Argentina will drag Brazil along. Mexico will be drawn in. We can have a new system, a credit-based system, if we get a couple of the leading world powers. It must include the United States, and it probably must include Russia. You get that core of opposition to the British, and it's got to be a self-conscious recognition that this is a political brawl. This is not a competition among good ideas and which one is the best idea. LaRouche's proposal is the only thing that will work. It's the only thing that will save civilization. And for it to be achieved, the British are going to have to be kicked in the tail. And if they don't like it, that they can stage a walkout and have a new financial system put together without them included. And they're going to have to come back begging hats in hand to get involved. This is hardball politics. The survival of the human race is on the table in the immediate weeks and months ahead. And LaRouche has the clearest sense of any living human being right now of what the stakes are and what must be done.
Well, you just heard from Jeffrey Steinberg. We're talking about the prospects for a new Bretton Woods. And I would add, this is not just a question of can we get it. As Jeff has explained, and we've heard repeatedly from Mr. LaRouche, if we don't get it, there's not going to be much that we'll be able to sit around and talk about, because we see the breakdown of nations, of shipping, of food production. We're watching as hundreds of billions of dollars are being added virtually every day to the debt of the United States. I just wrote a report yesterday that almost every single week we're finding out the state of California, is $1 billion more in deficit. So this can't be postponed. Diana, do you have anything else you want to add, any other thoughts on the situation and what you're doing?
Well, I mean, today we had a discussion with Lynn this morning, and he couldn't have been more blunt about the necessity for people to understand that any iota of an idea to hold on to the current monetary system means death for the world. I mean, he went through, you know, bankruptcy reorganization is actually very simple. The principle of it, it's guided by the Constitution of the United States, and in terms of the process, what you do is, you know, you're going to have two piles of monetary claims. You know, you would call them monetary claims. One is a little pile, and one is a big pile. It's a huge pile, and given the fact I'm on air, I'm going to call it a pile of feces. Those weren't the exact word Lynn used, but the big pile of feces, and we're gonna keep it in the fridge. we're gonna keep it in the fridge. Well, we won't really deal with it, but the pile of monetary claims, the smaller pile, well, we'll honor them accordingly, right? We'll turn them into credit, and that has to be understood by people that, you know, any existential questions people have about, well, how do we do it? How do we make sure everybody gets their share back? LaRouche says no, not everybody will get their quote unquote share back. The people who didn't deserve it, who didn't earn it, doesn't get it back.
And so you have a good sense from this that what Lynn means when he says no compromise.
No compromise, absolutely none. Nothing, no compromises, no wavering. You know, don't give in to the people's opinions. You know, they might, you know, alter it or change it here and there. You know, add a bow, add some glitter. Lynn says no, we don't want to compromise. There are some things you don't compromise on, and that's principle.
Mm-hmm. Delonte, I just wanted to ask you, because I know that you've been working on the question that is also posed by Lynn of developing the means of communicating ideas more powerfully through drama, through the principle of tragedy, through music. What's your sense at this point of the capability of reaching people with a population again caught up in hip hop and Hollywood. You're right out there in the middle of it. How do you approach getting these ideas across?
It's funny you said that, because we take the lessons of Boccaccio, and instead of sitting on the hill of the Rhine, we sit on the hill of Hollywood and watch the decrepit, just degenerate state of California collapse. There's still, with that, you still have within our generation a diamond in the rough, if you will, where there's still left a sense of dignity and morale that we can use with the function of these kinds of ideas around the Kepler, the music, the classical composition, and the tragedy work that we're doing with Robert Beltran and others. We've been able to use that because, listen, our generation has to get serious, and so we have to bring them up to speed very quickly on these higher level classical ideas. Because if we're looking at it right, and we're looking at the United States, we can see our generation really as an institution. The youth can act as that, as part of an institution of the presidency. A good example of that is what the civil rights movement was able to do, and being outside of the so-called formalities of the government, but then therefore able to change policy and enact new policies to change, and with the effect of what we see now, we've changed history. They were able to change history. So we could take that kind of principle of the institution of the presidency, but we need to have the level of intellectual and moral citizens, and it primarily is going to come from the 18 to 35 bracket. And I think this is the key for at least a longer term perspective. And what the power of the United States has is as not being a parliamentarian kind of linear system, rather, of rules and laws with dukes and lords, et cetera, but having institutions that can change the dynamics of policies in their country, in their republic. So we are using those ideas to recruit a institution of young people to do that. Yeah.
And Jeff, let me come back to, we've got about 7.5 minutes to go. I want to make sure that people understand this next 10-day period. On the 11th of November, Lyndon LaRouche will be addressing a high-level private meeting, and then on the 18th, something that everyone who's listening to this program can be involved in, the webcast at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. It will be live on the LaRouche PAC website. Now, coming out of that meeting, obviously we don't expect there's going to be a solution on the 15th. The Europeans said over the next 100 days, we're going to see an acceleration of the crash. How do you think that this is going to, well, let me put it directly. We've got a new administration in the United States. How do we move this administration?
Well, you know, Lyndon LaRouche has been emphasizing in a number of recent writings and discussions that under our constitutional system, yes, there's elections every 4 years, and yes, an individual is elected president of the United States. And the overwhelming majority of people elected president of the United States over the scope of our history have been at best mediocrities. We've had a handful of outstanding presidents. Obviously, Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt come to mind. We've had a few people who you could, you know, quite easily characterize as traitors or foreign agents. I mean, the consequences of the 8 years of Bush and Cheney have been more disastrous than anything that any enemy of the United States could have plotted from the outside. But we have something more than that because the nation survived. The Constitution has survived well over 200 years. And the point is that the executive branch is much larger than the people clustered around the Oval Office. You have the institution of the presidency, which is made up of a large number of people, many people in government, every living former president, people who are retired diplomats, retired intelligence officers, retired military officers, leading private citizens. Lyndon LaRouche is typical of that, who are called upon on occasions to take actions on behalf of the executive branch, the institution of the presidency. So all of these factors come to bear. Sometimes a president who's distinctly unqualified and unprepared for the job is best viewed as a kind of a figurehead who can, you know, talk the talk, but basically does what he's told. There are mechanisms by which real decision-making power is asserted in the United States that, again, is a unique feature of our Constitution. In Europe, it's a system that's designed to retain private oligarchical power by a financial oligarchy by having government be a clown show. Parliamentary systems that are inherently unstable, rely on weak coalitions, can have the plug pulled on them on a moment's notice. They don't function. If you want to get a graphic picture of this, check out C-SPAN during the evening when they broadcast the session of the British House of Commons when the Prime Minister appears. It's the gong show. It's politics as a bad, dirty joke.
Oh, yeah.
So the point is that you know, we're going to have a problem. Obama's not qualified for the job. He was put in that job because the British wanted at all costs to prevent Hillary Clinton from getting the nomination and winning the election because, frankly, they saw that among all of the candidates, she was the only one who had an impulse towards Franklin Roosevelt. And if the truth be told, there's a certain deep-seated fear within the British establishment that there's been a working relationship between the Clintons and Lyndon LaRouche. And this is something that scares the hell out of them. So you've got somebody who was chosen by the British because he's a very good sophist orator, but has no qualifications for the job, is owned pretty much lock, stock, and barrel by people who represent the very financial institutions and interests that are going to have to be overturned.
Such as George Soros.
Soros, Rowett, and you name it.
Yeah.
We've got a problem, and it would be a folly to underestimate the challenge that stands before us. But look, we are going to be hit in the immediate days and weeks ahead with a phase of this financial systemic collapse that is going to stun people who even thought they've been through hell over the last 14-month period since July of last year, 2007, when LaRouche said the crash has already started. So that's going to be a wake-up call, and therefore, between Russia, China, India, the efforts coming out of Italy, some of the thoughts coming out of Sarkozy in France, people around the incoming administration who have a sense of what LaRouche has been saying, they've been following and reading LaRouche's writings, a few brave souls have even dared to sit down in the same room with him on a couple of occasions. All of these factors are at play, but ultimately, the magnitude of the shock collapse of this system, the system as a whole, is going to hit like a nuclear bomb in the immediate weeks ahead. As I said at the beginning, the French financial press is anticipating that a failure on November 15th itself will trigger the final disintegration of the whole system. So we're heading for times that are unprecedented, and to the extent that we remain standing and forthright that it's our way or hell, we've got a real shot of winning.
Well, and that's the point on this question of no compromise. I would urge everyone who's listening to go on the website, the LaRouche PAC website. If you're listening, you're already on it. So take a look at the videos. Download some of the writings, including Mr. LaRouche's longer paper on the Brutish, how to defeat the Brutish Empire. Get the shorter statement, the Whereas paper, which describes how the new Bretton Woods would work, and go out and organize. Get your friends to listen to this program and line them up to listen on November 18th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time to the next webcast by Lyndon LaRouche. This is the moment where the moment of truth for the United States. Our system can work, but it depends on the citizens. And that's you. And don't forget to write checks to LaRouche PAC, because we can't do this for nothing. So thank you for joining us today, Jeff and Diana and Delonte. And to our listeners, this has been the LaRouche Show. We'll be back next Saturday, and then we'll be right, actually we'll be doing the next program during the Bush-Brown seance at the White House. So hopefully we'll be active before and after that. Join us next Saturday for the LaRouche Show at 3 p.m. Eastern Time.